You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about raising meat chickens and is it worth it? So I think this is going to be a really interesting topic to talk about. And then in our worldview segment, it is on to secular humanism. And well, let's just get started right now with success through action. We're talking about schedules today and
right.
How important scheduling is, scheduling your day, et cetera. Now, of course, you know, many people's schedules are largely determined for them, but there's a lot that you can influence in your scheduling.
Yeah. And even if you know certain jobs you have to do, or tasks that need to be done, and maybe someone else is assigned that to you, you still have flexibility within that to be able to decide, you know, when you'll be doing each thing throughout the day.
Right. And I think the bottom line is that the more you schedule your day, the more productive you're going to be.
Right.
So in other words, you could have a to-do list, which is a fantastic tool, and probably if you do nothing else, that's the thing that you should do. But if you go beyond that and then schedule your day, you're going to be much more productive.
Right. Exactly. Because you know what you're supposed to be doing. I know the times that I have had my days really planned out, and it's usually when you're deployed. Because when you deploy, I get really, really organized because I have to do it all myself. There's no relief
right.
anywhere.
Well, that is a good point.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that kind of that principle of the more you're restricted, the more creative you have to be, the more efficient you have to be.
Yeah.
And so conversely, you get loose when,
yeah.
you know, you don't have to worry about it.
Right. And
same thing with money,
same thing with
your time.
Yes. And all these things, it's easier to just relax and be like, whatever, I've got, you know, I don't have as much on me right now. Mm-hmm. Or, we're doing pretty good with money, so I don't have to worry about budgeting.
Yeah.
And you end up being a lot looser. The times that we've had least amount of money, we've been the most strict with our...
And we've used it the most wisely.
Yeah, and we've still been able to save and everything, even with less money. So,
yeah. So like, I guess the key then is developing self-discipline to do those kinds of things, regardless of whether or not you have a plethora of time or a plethora of money.
Yeah, and honestly, this is one thing that is equal across the board for every single person on this entire planet. Everyone is given 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And you can use it as wisely or as unwisely as you want.
Right.
And if you can have a mediocre life and not plan your day and just kind of go with whatever happens to you, or you can have a successful life and be very productive with the hours that you're given.
Absolutely. So we have this kind of this idea of the block system.
The block system.
So what is that?
Well, a block system is basically a system where you have a certain block of time, and for some people that may be 15 minutes.
Like professionals, so lawyers and accountants, they go down to the 15-minute block.
Right.
Especially with their clients.
Right, because they're charging for that 15 minutes.
Right.
And that it may be a 30-minute block, or it may be an hour block that you're saying, for this hour or for this 30 minutes, I'm going to do this task or this particular thing, whatever it may be. It may be daily tasks that you know I have to get these done every single day, or it may be a weekly thing. And so you're taking that and sticking it in a time period or a block of time. We've talked about making lists, like what tasks do I do every single day, and how long does it take me, how many blocks
right.
of this time, and then a weekly tasks.
Yes.
And then plugging those in throughout your day, so you
right.
know what you're doing.
Yeah, I certainly had that in the past, a daily to-do list. And these are the things that happen every day, just like you said. And it could be things like, hey, you're studying a particular subject, or you're reading a particular genre of books. And so you want to spend, say, 30 minutes a day reading, you know, focused reading on that book, not just putting on your to-do list. Oh, I got to, you know, my daily to-do list, reading. Well, a lot of times you won't get to that.
Yeah.
Well, but if you schedule it out, the likelihood is that you will.
Right. And we've talked about that with email as well, because email, like Facebook or other...
You can get sucked right in.
Yeah. Pretty soon you're looking at newsletters you've received and you're clicking on all the links, and the next thing you know, you've been on email for an hour and a half.
Yes. instead that is of a great focus example time. Of focus time. So, and maybe it depends on the individual. It depends on your industry or whether you own your own business or whatever. Maybe email is like key to your business. And so maybe it's something that you need to be on like 3 times a day.
Right.
But maybe that's 3 half-hour blocks of email, and you can be very productive and very focused instead of constantly being on email.
Yeah, because that honestly, in the past when I have had, when email has been kind of
really important,
an extremely important time, I've had to schedule it. Otherwise, I was continually responding to somebody or taking care of an emergency or having to reach out and email somebody else because something else came up. And when I started scheduling it, I set that aside and, okay, I'm going to go into my email at this time. I'm going to spend that half hour and I'm going to stop.
Right.
I can't do it all every day. Otherwise, I'd get nothing else done.
Right. Exactly. You know, another good example to talk about is phone calls. Mm-hmm. So there's some people have a need in their business to talk on the phone. And this is the same kind of thing. So outside of, you know, responding to customers or clients, it's this, when do you call people? So, mm-hmm. So this needs to be thought out, obviously. There's, you know, you don't say, okay, 6 o'clock in the morning, first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to call all my clients. Well, of course not.
They're sleeping.
So, you know, that needs to be thought through as well. You might have, for a salesman, it might be like cold calls. Well, he's not going to schedule that. He's going to schedule, depending on the demographic that he's going for. And it might be, you know, late morning, or it might be, you know, after the normal work hours type of phone calls.
Yeah. And I know as a homeschool mom, there were many years where I did not accept calls during certain times, especially when the children were young.
Sure.
Because I was actively teaching and I knew if I get on that phone, I'm going to be stuck on that phone and the kids are going to act like animals.
Right.
It's going to get out of control. Mom's on the phone.
Before you know it, 2 hours just slipped by and you didn't get half the
right.
things you wanted to
Our
get
things
done.
Didn't get done. And now we have to get moving because we're supposed to be doing something else.
Right.
Or lunch is here or whatever. So I didn't answer the phone during particular hours simply because of that. And
yeah.
So that may be something, you know, even as a homesteader, you go, okay, you know, this is our project time, or this is our school time, or this is our active work time, and I can't be screening calls or taking calls during these particular times.
Right. I guess so the bottom line for today is scheduling your day as much as possible. The more you can schedule out your day, the more productive you're going to be. And, you know, not that we do this perfectly.
We don't. But we're trying. I mean,
yes,
this is
something
that we're really trying
for,
to
in
incorporate.
Because we know the value of it.
Yeah.
And so right now, we obviously match up those required things that we need to be at. We match up things that we're working on together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really working on dialing that down to scheduling out our day, you know, down to the half hour at
least. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to the worldview segment. And for today, we're continuing our, series on isms. And today we want to talk about secular humanism. And this is really important because I think that a large part of our culture, whether it's recognized or not, it is certainly secular humanist.
Yeah, it is. And what is, I think, a little bit disconcerting is most people don't understand that from the secular humanist point of view, it is an all fully comprehensive, what do you call it? Philosophy.
Worldview.
That touches every aspect of life. Now, this is what Christianity is supposed to do.
Yeah, right.
It is supposed to touch every aspect of life.
Now, unfortunately, most Christians mistake this and they chop up their lives into categories and they'll put their Christianity in this one or that one, but not have it bleed over. And it's a misunderstanding that our faith should touch every area of life.
Yeah, it should be. We should be living out our faith in every aspect. And for them, I'm actually on the website secularhumanism.org. And this is a little bit of what they say. It is comprehensive, touching every aspect of life, including issues of values, meaning, and identity. Thus, it is broader than atheism, which concerns only the non-existence of God or the supernatural. Important as that may be, there's a lot more to life, and secular humanism addresses it. they claim to be non-religious, but I would argue.
Well, even the Supreme Court determined that secular humanism obtains the same status as religion.
Right.
So, well, in their beliefs.
And this is, secular humanism is what is being taught in our public education system.
For sure.
From kindergarten all the way through our university system right. here in America.
And I think another thing that's important in this is to understand that secular humanism is not a new thing. It's not something that came about, you know, since Obama came into office.
No.
It's been around for a long, long time. And in fact, Humanist Manifesto 1, there's three of them, came out in 1933. So it's been around for a long time. Humanist Manifesto 2 was in 1973. Humanist Manifesto 3, it was published in 2003. These are very important documents to read if you're interested more in the subject. It's very telling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we obviously don't have time to read them here, but it's important to understand. So if we look at some of their tenets or their philosophy, it's obviously naturalistic.
Yes. Well, and I find this intriguing because one of the things they say here is says, naturalism asserts that supernatural entities like God do not exist and warns us that knowledge gained without appeal to the natural world and without impartial review by multiple observers is unreliable. They also say that you can only find any information using the scientific method. Well, evolution doesn't use the scientific method.
No.
Because you can't test it.
Evidential science, supposedly it's evidential science.
Right, but it's guesses.
Right.
It's guesses. Well, right. It's saying, well, I think this happened because...
You can't observe it.
Right, you can't observe it and you can't repeat it.
Right.
That is the scientific method.
Yeah. It has to be repeatable, measurable, etc.
Right.
Now, you made a claim just a minute ago. You made a pretty strong claim. You said that basically that secular humanism is what is being taught in public education.
Right.
Now, I want to add on that real quick. And that in Humanist Manifesto 1 of 1933, one of the main signers, probably the most famous signer of the Humanist Manifesto, was John Dewey. And what is John Dewey known as?
He's the founder of public education in America.
The father of modern public education.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you're exactly right. And so, obviously, we know that secular humanism, which is naturalistic, so it denies any supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
It says that there's no design to us, and ultimately, they'd have to admit there's no purpose.
Right, and I think they actually do say that in their papers or stuff here somewhere. That there is no, we're here by accident.
Yeah, and so it would go hand in hand with materialism, of course. And, you know, if you were to read through these manifestos, you would see how deep-rooted they are in our culture. I mean, this is the basis for our culture with a sprinkling of spirituality, and,
yeah.
You know, other sprinklings of this and that, but we are largely a secular humanist society.
Yeah, and the other thing that we read about today is their ethical system. It's a consequentialist ethical system, and they say this is in contrast to so-called command ethics, in which right and wrong are defined in advance and attributed to divine authority. So for us, we know that in Scripture, we can find what is moral and what is immoral, what is what should be law, and we don't have that necessarily in America, and what is wrong, according
right.
to God, our Creator, who can tell us all of these things. But they say, no God will save us, declared Humanist Manifesto 2 from 1973. We must save ourselves. Secular humanists seek to develop and improve their ethical principles by examining the result they yield in the lives of real men and women.
Right, so it's all based on how it turned out. And if it turned out well, then that was a good decision.
Yeah, and then I would ask, well, who's the determiner
right,
of what turns out good or bad?
The reality is that what this leads to is just anything and everything goes.
Yeah.
You have to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
Because for someone, it had to be a good result. You know, and so therefore they can look back and say, well, yeah, I was right. If it's basically, if it, I don't want to say that it feels good, do it, but that is obviously part of it. But if it turned out well for them, then it was fine. It's going to be justified, rationalized.
And there are, like, abortion, we could look at abortion from this consequential ethics point of view, and they would say, well, it's right, it's good, it should continue because women aren't saddled with, you know, this responsibility of a baby they don't want to have. Not
saddled with the, you know,
these
the
unwanted,
et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, okay. I think that kind of covers that loosely. Secular humanism. This is really important because this is what, I mean, this is the foundation of our society. This is what you'll find in public education from prenatal all the way through the university system.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Christians, our response is to be faithful to the scriptures.
Yeah, and to recognize these things. Don't just take it and accept these things as true, but always be looking at it through the realm of scripture.
Right. So like the secular humanist who has a comprehensive worldview, so the Christian must have a comprehensive biblical worldview.
Right. Truth Project is a really good thing to watch if you're interested in learning more about maybe how your
worldview is
messed up a little bit.
Christians don't recognize it.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that covers it. Let's move on to our main topic for today. And that is, we're asking this question. Is it worth it to raise meat chickens? Okay, to raise your own meat, and we're talking about chickens specifically. You could ask this question with just about anything. But we just recently, we were in the process of raising meat chickens. We process birds for other people, for customers. And, you know, so we talk to people a lot about this. They come and they pay us to process for them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain amount of work involved here. There's lots of money being put out, and, you know, there's a lot of risk, you know, live animals, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so we're asking this question and we're talking about it. And I want to start with this. If money is your only reason, you know, on whether or not you raise a meat chicken, the answer is you're probably going to end up just going to the store and buying chicken there.
Well, yeah, especially if you start adding in your labor.
Sure.
You start paying yourself even minimum wage because there's people out there who have figured out how many hours a day they commit and gave themselves minimum wage, you know, and use that as, wow, I'm paying this ridiculous amount of money per chicken raising my own. Then
the answer is probably going to be go to the store and buy the commercial chicken injected with, you know, the saline solution.
Right. Raised inhumanely.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the reality of it. Now, there are ways to raise meat chickens very inexpensively, and we're going to talk about some of those ways today. But the reality is that the answer to that question, or what we just said about going to the store and buying it, if you're going to include all those things, is the reason why we have the commercial chicken house.
Yeah.
It's why there's 10,000 chickens in every single chicken house with two employees.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how they bring you $1.25 a pound chicken.
Yeah, or less sometimes.
I
mean, honestly, there's some really cheap chicken out there. No, you're getting what you pay for.
You're getting nasty.
Just saying. Meat, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so, I mean, look, obviously we believe it is beneficial, and we think the answer is yes, it is worth it to raise your own meat chickens. But we want to talk about, well, how do we do this? I mean, let's include finances. Let's try and do this inexpensively. We say that raising all of your own food is half a living, but we need to figure out ways to reduce those costs so that we can actually make a living.
Yeah, you need to take the cost of it into consideration.
Right. So we're gonna give you our example here. And we're making some assumptions, so just bear with us. We're going to keep everything round numbers to make it simple. First of all, we ran across a great deal and were able to buy 100 chickens.
130, right?
130. Yeah, that's what it ended up being. But the deal was 100 chickens for $100.
Okay.
And they were black Australorps and Rhode Island Red, you know, which are considered dual breeds. Now, these are not the standard Cornish cross, which is the king of the meat chicken, both for the commercial industry and those raising, you know, pastured poultry. You know, the Cornish cross is the most common commercial breed that can get up to weight in 7 or 8 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, very efficient and all that. So we're not raising those, but we paid $100. We were able to actually get $130. This is an incredible deal. At a hatchery, you're probably going to pay closer to, depending on how many you buy. If you buy in bulk, you might be able to pay something like $1.75 a bird, depending on the breed. So this was a really great deal. So we had $100 for these birds. But again, we're going to have some assumptions here to make things simple. And what we're going to do is say, at the end, because we did have some losses,
mm-hmm.
is we're going to only account for 100 birds.
Just going to round down.
Yeah, we're going to round down. Okay, now, one of the biggest costs is feed costs.
Yeah.
And we don't buy certified organic feed. We buy non-GMO feed. And it happens to be what's considered an all stock, you know, for all of our animals. So it's wheat, barley, and peas, and they do fine on it. It does require a little bit of supplementation with minerals and scraps and things like that that we do to make sure they have everything they need. We buy in bulk, and this helps us out. We buy a ton at a time. And we buy it for $345. Okay, $345 for 2,000 pounds of food. Now, we got to talk about now is the feed-to-meat ratio. And this goes with any homestead animal or any animal you're raising for meat. You know, this is an important number. So it's tricky, and you can go out there and you can find lots of different opinions on this and, you know, different experiments that have been conducted by that are people who are trying to live sustainably or self-sufficiently. And so you see a lot of different feed conversion rates. Now, the industry, the commercial industry that raises nothing but Cornish crosses, they advertise 2-to-1. So in other words, for every pound of meat with the animal that's fully dressed, it's 2 pounds of feed. Okay, now I have not run across any even pastured poultry or homesteaders who can claim that. That's just the truth. Most will claim somewhere around 5-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and a lot of times that has to do with maybe using heritage breeds versus the Cornish cross or anything like that. I don't want to get into too much detail about that, but our assumption is this. We're going to be conservative, and we're going to use a feed to meat ratio of 6-to-1. So in other words, when we're all done and the animal's dressed and weighed, there's 6 pounds of feed for every pound of meat.
Mm-hmm.
So here's our assumptions. We're going to have 100 birds at the end of all this. We'll have gotten a feed to a conversion rate of 6-to-1. And what that turns out to be is essentially 18 pounds of feed for a 3-pound dressed chicken.
Right.
Okay, if you multiply that out, essentially we're using 1 ton of feed for these 100 chickens.
If we're rounding up.
Yeah, we're going to round up. Because we did lose some birds, and they obviously ate a little bit
mm-hmm.
prior to that. So we're going to say we use 1 ton, which was $345. So if you look at just feed alone per chicken, when again, we're assuming a 3-pound chicken. We haven't processed these guys yet. That is $3.45 in feed per chicken. If you add to that the dollar that it cost us for each one of them, that's $4.35 per chicken. Now, if we add the shrink wrap bag, which are about how much?
I think 15 to 20 cents
okay.
a piece.
Okay, and then we'll even add in a little bit of fudge.
Yeah.
So let's call it $5 a chicken?
$5.
Okay, that's probably a pretty accurate number for us. Now, I'm sure there's lots of people out there who've done better than that and worse than
that. Worse,
yeah. And obviously we're always working on trying to improve that ratio.
Right, but that comes to $1.66 a pound.
$1.66 a pound for a pasture-raised chicken that we know how it was raised, we know how it was processed, we know what it ate.
Yeah, and it lived like a chicken.
It lived like a chicken.
I'm happy with that. You know, when I go in, when we used to buy chicken at the store, whether it was Costco or Walmart or Safeway or whatever, I felt guilty. And I'm not, you know, an animal activist, but I am an animal lover. Mm-hmm. I mean, I care about all of our animals that we have here and all animals really everywhere. I think that we need to be good stewards and take care of the ones that are depending on us or are weaker than us. And when I know how the chicken's been raised, you know, squished into a small confined area, squished in with all these other chickens, never seeing the light of day, never getting to touch grass or live in a pasture. And then they were slaughtered inhumanely and then injected with chemical stuff and stuck in a bag for me to buy at the grocery store. I got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. It was like, I can't buy this anymore. I don't feel right about it.
Right. So we end up buying the organic chickens and
Try and find pasture raised. Yeah. Which then you're paying a fortune for, like through different companies that will carry things like you're paying a fortune way more than we spend raising our own pasture raised, humanely raised chickens.
One thing that, you made me think about it when you said they were injected with, you know, the saline solution with, I'm sure there's chemicals in there and everything else. So when you go to the store and even when you buy the cheap chicken, you're not getting, even if it's a, I don't care if it's 99 cents a pound. Well, that was a chicken that was added 30%.
Right.
So you have to reduce that by 30%. Which takes up the price per pound, per actual pound. And then, you know, you were talking about how when you cook it down.
When you bake a chicken.
That 30%.
That liquid all falls down to the bottom of the pan, which can make great gravy. But your chicken is a whole lot smaller than when it started out.
Right. So as opposed to a pasture chicken, which is not really reducing down that much.
You're not going to change the amount of meat.
Right. So that is a trick of the industry that, of course, they have their, you know, their reasons for doing it. But the reality is that they get more money by injecting liquid into your chicken.
Right. Because they weigh it after it's been injected.
Of course. So that has to be kept in mind as well. But then, and let's be honest about this, you know, to go into the store and buy it, I don't have to do anything.
Right.
Here on the homestead, we've got to take care of them every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've
got to move their tractor every day.
Got to feed them, make sure they have water.
And chase them around if they get out, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a whole lot more work involved, but that's part of what you commit to when you're doing a homestead.
Well, right. And if you're going to make the mistake, I would say, of trying to put a dollar amount on everything you do, or, you know, that's why I really don't like the idea of time is money. Well, that depends. You know, if you're doing what you're enjoying doing, and you feel there's purpose and meaning in what you're doing, why would you put a dollar amount on that? And especially raising your own chicken.
Right. Well, and that's, I think this is where there's a difference between homesteaders and somebody who'd be living in the city is that is our commitment. We are committed to that. And so for us, the extra work we put in is sweat equity, and we do value our time, but that's time well spent because we know it's investing in our health, our children's health, and the animals, which is meaningful to us.
Right. Absolutely. So you mentioned many different reasons, and we're obviously making the case that raising your own meat is a very good thing, regardless of $1.66 a pound and your work. But there's also the health aspect.
Yes.
I mean, you can't, how do you measure that? As far as, you know, eating commercial chicken versus eating pasture-raised chicken, there is a difference.
There is a difference, yeah. Over the long run, your body feels the difference. And it's been, I think, proven so many times when people change the way they eat and the meat they're taking in because of the hormones and the antibiotics and things that they're having to feed these animals to keep them alive during the time that they're in this. That we're ingesting that and we're putting it into our bodies. And so this, you know, being able to raise your own chickens and your own meat is making a huge difference in your overall health.
Right. Now, one of the things that we're getting to the point here of saying is that obviously we think it's a good idea, but there's value added. It's not just the healthy meat.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's actually a pretty reasonable price to pay for very healthy meat. And that is all of the value added that a chicken brings to the land.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, we run them in chicken tractors. We move them once a day. They're dropping nutrient in that spot. That land, the soil fertility of that land is improving over the years.
Right.
So you have to at least add that intangible effect in as well.
Well, yeah, and pasture sanitization coming behind the animals. And on top of that, the decrease in bug population because sure. they're keeping it under control.
Yeah. I mean, so we have less, we don't have mosquito problems or huge bug problems here on the property.
Right.
And that's one of the, you know, one of the benefits
yeah, of buying chickens. And again, this is something we talked about before is, you know, our scraps, being able to take something from our kitchen that would normally be considered garbage.
Right.
And throwing it into the chickens who think, you know, they've just gotten the best feast in the whole planet. And
right.
it's contributing to the weight, which eventually we'll be eating.
Right.
So it all kind of works together.
Absolutely.
Perfectly.
And so... the pasture is sanitized. The pasture fertility is increased. We run our meat chickens through our food forest, which is going to increase the fertility of the food forest, which eventually, and I, you know, we won't be able to prove this, but I don't see how you could come to any other conclusion. We're going to get more fruit and we're going to get more,
right.
more nuts and berries and things like that, you know, from the food forest due to the animal disturbance there because of those chickens.
Right. You know, and if more people raised their own chickens, their own meat chickens, it would decrease the need for commercialized programs, which are hard on the environment. I'm not an environmentalist, but it doesn't contribute positively to the environment or even to the health of people, and certainly not to the health of these animals.
Sure.
So if each family just is committed to raising their own meat chickens
right.
each year, it would decrease the even necessity of
yeah.
all these commercialized programs
right.
and systems that they've got going on.
There's another intangible benefit to raising your own meat, and that is, it's hard to even quantify or qualitatively talk about, and that is the raising of your own meat, taking a bird from chick status to the table. There's an intangible benefit
yeah.
there for the entire family. I think we treasure eating that meat more.
We do. I know whenever we're eating, you know, rabbit or a chicken or a duck that we've butchered, that we've raised, there's, you know, we all go, oh, this is what we just butchered this 3 days ago. Or
right. And there's something to be, everybody's like a little bit more excited. They're a little bit more thankful.
Thankful. Yeah, because they know there was work involved in this, in the raising, and they were involved in every step along the way of that food being on the table. It's a whole lot different than going to the store where you
yeah.
don't, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
It's just has magically appeared in plastic wrap in the freezer section of
right.
the store.
I know. It's crazy. On our last podcast, we were talking about reducing feed costs, and you know that it's obviously applicable here too. And one of the things we talked about last time was using forage, or you know, raising your animals more so at certain times of the year than others.
Right.
And so, and same thing with meat chickens.
Mm-hmm.
This is it's really a seasonal thing. Of course, you can do it year round, but you're getting the reduced feed costs because you're raising them in the time of the year where grass is growing and all that. So.
Right. Yeah. So you're not going to want to be wintering a bunch of meat chickens.
Right. And of course, you know, people do it, and the commercial industry obviously does it. It doesn't matter then to them what time of year it is.
Well, yeah, because they're in warehouses. They're
right.
inside.
They're not using forage at all. So that would help. And all these little things put together can reduce your costs. Now, if you are going to count all your labor, if you're going to count you know, every bit of cost that it took you to make that chicken tractor, which we're obviously not right now. But again, as the seasons go by, that becomes less and less and less and less. You know, if you're going to count all that and if you're going to pay someone else to process for you, that's going to be an expensive chicken.
Yeah.
But the likelihood is it's still worth it.
Yeah. I would say it's still worth it.
Right. And, you know, I think that when you talk about the resiliency impact that raising your own meat has on a homestead, on a community, that's huge. I mean, there's when everybody is dependent on Walmart for their food, it's not good.
We're more vulnerable.
Very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And so that's an important aspect of this.
Yeah. Self-reliance. Just knowing that if everything goes bad and if the stores suddenly are not stocked, we can still make it. We can still live. We still have good food and we're not just eking by.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing okay.
We're doing okay. You know, we'd have to make some adjustments, of course, but we'd be in a lot better position.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it would be easy. It wouldn't. But, you know, knowing that we have meat on our homestead and we've got food that's starting to grow and we've planted all those trees, it gives you a security that you wouldn't normally have.
Sure. So I think it's pretty clear for us.
Mm-hmm.
That raising meat chickens is a very much a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah.
Our scripture for today is Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.